jobs, and moreover, only in places that are experiencing an acute shortage of labor. In other words, given Russia's demographic distribution, only to those places that were barely inhabited. Domestically, the Russian papers could point to trials where alleged wreckers admitted to their crimes, such as placing bombs in order to cause mines to collapse, even though the charges were, in every sense of the term, incredible. As one member of the French National Federation of Miners pointed out, "I defy any technician, however competent, to organize the systematic placing of a mine in an explosive state without the inspectors, even if they were complete idiots, perceiving it within an hour. If the Service of Inspection for the Security of the Mines at Kemerovo did not perceive this thing, it is either incompetent or non-existent. If it exists, it is even more culpable than the other accused, and since it is the mode in Moscow to shoot, its members should be the first to be shot. If it did not exist, then we were lied to about the protection of the workers' safety." The arts themselves fared even worse. Art by its nature is open to interpretation, which would itself be a crime in a system where vacillating from the officially decreed truth could be derided as counter-revolutionary or petty bourgeois or whatever the slur of the moment happened to be. Dmitri Shostakovich was and remains one of the great composers of all time, an innovator in an era where innovation was dying in a country where innovation was suspect. On January 26, 1936, Stalin stormed out of the premiere of Shostakovich's new opera, Lady Macbeth of Mytensk. 2 days later, Shostakovich was in the far north town of Archangel to attend some performances. There he saw the headline in Pravda, "Muddle Instead of Music," reviewing his newest work as a grotesquerie suited to the perverted taste of the bourgeois. 10 days after that came a newspaper attack on one of Shostakovich's ballets, accusing him of formalism, a term that basically meant heretical, and he himself a slick and high-handed fraud. The message was clear and clearly understood by his colleagues, who took it upon themselves to denounce him publicly. Some in the artistic community still stood up for the brilliant composer. The writer Elyezhnev said that, "I view the incident with Shostakovich as the advent of the same order that burns books in Germany." Elyezhnev would be the first to be tortured and shot. Theater director Vsevolod Meyerhold denounced the angry, cruel headlines and complained that his friend is now in very bad shape. As for Meyerhold, Shostakovich had often stayed in his Moscow apartment. It was there that the director's wife, the actress Zinaida Reich, was stabbed to death in the eyes and their apartment given to an NKVD chauffeur. Mikhail Tukhachevsky, a marshal of the Soviet Union, wrote to Stalin to defend Shostakovich. He too was tortured and shot, and his body dumped in a landfill. Shostakovich's librettist, Adrian Pyotrovsky, was arrested and shot. A former lover of Shostakovich, the writer Galina Sebryakova, was vanished. The composer's brother-in-law, a brilliant physicist known for his research into liquid crystals, his sister Maria, his mother-in-law, his uncle, all were arrested. Even if the man in the street felt something wasn't quite adding up, it was very difficult for him to get the full picture, especially in a culture where questioning authority could have deadly consequences for oneself and one's entire family. The newspapers were full of boasts about enormous achievements of production and the success of heroic Stakhanovite workers, yet there were no clothes in the stores and no food on the shelves. Clearly, there was some disconnect. Sure, the papers might make mistakes or have a bias, but they couldn't realistically be filled with lies week after week, year after year. That would be a conspiracy theory of the highest order, which is obviously absurd. Only crazy people would think there was a conspiracy to control the news and what information reached the public. The only possible logical alternative was that someone must have been keeping the productive socialist bounty from reaching the people. It had to be the wreckers. It is not hard to convince a person that a given article is deceptive or that all the newspapers were to some extent fudging the truth. The papers were written by human beings, and human beings make mistakes or are blinded by their worldview. As Upton Sinclair famously said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. Yet as fallible as humans are, one could at least count on the camera to tell the truth. A photograph was, ostensibly, an objective capture of a moment in time. Yet even here, the Soviet authorities put their hands to work with the practice of unpersoning. Trotsky was airbrushed out of a famous picture of him alongside Lenin in Red Square, for example. A viewer seeing the photo would logically conclude that he had misremembered things, for there was Lenin delivering his speech by himself in black and white. As various communists lost favor, they would be vanished from imagery and thereby from history. Pictures of groups of men that included Stalin and Lenin would be reduced to just the two of them to illustrate an alleged closeness. One notorious picture of Stalin and three of his comrades was edited to display two of them, and then one, and then a final iteration of Stalin standing alone. By rewriting the past, even the past in recent memory, Stalin began to rewrite the present. Thus, as time went on, in one very specific way, the communist system started to work. As one Soviet escapee later wrote, "The search for truth, the urge to understand the meaning of life, is wholly alien to the younger generation which has passed through the school of the communist youth organization. For them, all problems have been solved. There is a standard answer to every question. The language of these intellectually impoverished young people is larded with ready-made phrases. They quote Stalin instead of thinking for themselves. They derive their opinion from Pravda editorials. They are arrogant and complacent, and everything that pertains to them is the greatest thing there is. Their country, their power, their leader. Theirs is also the greatest misery and oppression, but they are unaware of this, for they have never known anything but Soviet life. The members of this younger generation have neither sympathy nor understanding for their elders. There is no bond between them. If anyone puts forth a thought which does not fit into the pattern laid down by Stalin, they do not argue against it, but they react with such suspicion of the other's true intentions and hidden thoughts that he quickly learns to keep his ideas to himself. Yet a regime in complete control of the media and official communications is still unable to have complete control over critical thinking. All it takes is that one mind, one out of tens of millions, to ask uncomfortable questions, and from there, even some trusting people start to seek responses simply due to curiosity alone. Eventually, all the lies can turn the simplest person into an accountant simply because things didn't add up. One day, a communist could be posited as the greatest hero of the Soviets, and the next, he was one of the villains of all time. If he had been a villain the entire time, which was certainly possible, then at best, the information being presented had been mistaken and should have been taken with a grain of salt. At worst, the media and history books were grossly unreliable, in which case mass persuasion becomes infinitely more difficult. The Soviet Union was the biggest nation in the world and had a large population. Within that population were enough savvy people who saw the show trials for what they were, a farce in a country where things to laugh about were increasingly becoming the exception. Graffiti started to appear on factory walls, down with the murderer of the leaders of the October Revolution. This was an enormous problem for Stalin. As long as there could be conceivable alternatives to his reign, someone might choose to do something about it. There was one group of men who knew with absolute certainty and proof what he had been up to with the show trials and what his level of involvement was. He solved it like he solved so many of his other problems, through killing. In the fall of 1936, Stalin turned his guns on the interrogators themselves. He started at the top, switching out Genrikh Yagoda with Nikolai Yezhov as People's Commissar for the Interior, i.e. head of the NKVD, the newest iteration of the secret police. Stalin could claim innocence of the entire terror, for now he had Yagoda as a convenient scapegoat to blame, just as there had been scapegoats for all of the USSR's economic and social failures. Yagoda's downfall was an interesting case of careful what you wish for. Yezhov brought 300 officials with him. They were the understudies in Stalin's play of terror, and the entire main cast was about to be replaced. In March 1937, Yezhov dispersed many of the main NKVD personnel, ostensibly to have them check on various regions of the Soviet Union. Separated and isolated, the men would never reach their supposed destinations. Their assistants met with the same fates. Yezhov also took control of the passport group, so the agents couldn't travel abroad, and took control of the NKVD aviation squadrons, so they couldn't commandeer a plane. Then began the mass arrests of Stalin's secret police. Some of the interrogators turned to suicide, knowing full well the privations they would certainly face under arrest, for they themselves had been the perpetrators. A few jumped to their deaths from the NKVD's office windows in plain view during the day in central Moscow. There was not even the pretense of a trial for many of the others. 3,000 were executed in 1937 alone. Yagoda's judges, men who rubber-stamped the sentences of hundreds of thousands of innocent people, were also arrested en masse. Many prisoners found considerable satisfaction in meeting their own examining judges who had balled the accusation of counter-revolutionary and spy at them in prison on the same charges, wrote one survivor. For good measure, Yezhov arrested Yagoda's family, exiling the man's wife, parents, sisters, nieces, and nephews. Yagoda himself would finally be executed at the start of 1938. The biggest crime in the Soviet Union was knowing Stalin's secrets, and the inevitable penalty for even the suspicion of such a thing was death. In 1937, Stalin's purge reached the highest levels of the military as well, men who theoretically could have deposed Stalin in a coup. 8 leading Red Army generals were arrested, with the newspapers full of claims that they had been working for a foreign state, namely Nazi Germany. Within one day, they were all tried and executed, with no evidence of their crimes or even clarity as to their nature presented either publicly or abroad. The fact that 3 of them were Jewish was of little relevance to the already demented accusation. Stalin was more concerned about a hypothetical threat to him personally from his own generals than about the threat to the Soviet Union already being posed by Hitler. Losing some of the USSR's greatest elite military minds would cost many lives down the road during World War II, both in the Soviet Union itself and in Europe as a whole. Those who had owed their appointments to the 8 executed generals thereby fell under suspicion. 3 of the 5 marshals of the Red Army were arrested, as well as 13 out of 15 army commanders, 8 out of 9 admirals, 50 out of 57 army corps commanders, 154 out of 186 division commanders, 25 of 28 army corps commissars, and all 16 army commissars. Positions that were filled were just as quickly removed from office as well. It took months for the mania to die down until the top military brass was entirely staffed by men who owed their positions to Stalin. Voicing disapproval of any of this was grounds for arrest. Mikhail Tukhachevsky was Marshal of the Soviet Union, the highest position in the military, when he was executed for being a German spy in 1937. When one Russian woman heard the news, she commented about what a handsome man he had been. She was turned in and sentenced to 10 years for extolling an enemy of the people, an enemy of the people who had been the pride and joy of the USSR mere days prior. What Stalin unleashed with his great terror was an assault on civil society itself. The bourgeois model is very much predicated on private individuals looking after one another to some extent, whether as neighbors or as members of a church. Yet for Stalin, any connection that was private was a threat to the common good that was the basis of socialism. The private interconnections that make up civil society were transformed from being the basis of a nation's flourishing and stability into something to fear. Entire ethnicities within the USSR were rounded up and deported in an effort to sever the relations between the peoples and their ancestral lands to better remake the men and women in line with communist principles. The Kuban Cossacks had been deported to Siberia in the early 1930s, with parents and children automatically separated from one another in the process. Later, too, were deported 8 various nationalities, such as the Chechens, the Ingushi, and the Crimean Tatars, in numbers totaling roughly 1.75 million people. The Kalmyks, a population of Mongols who practiced Buddhism, were sent to the Far East where most of them perished. Kurds, Gypsies, Koreans, Finns, and Estonians were also uprooted en masse. The Greeks were accused of conspiring to hand over part of the Ukraine to Greece. 200,000 of them would be deported as a consequence of this nonsensical claim. Half of Kazakhstan's entire population eventually consisted of people exiled from other lands. One 1937 NKVD order demanded ethnic cleansing via the arrest of all remaining Polish war prisoners from the 1920-21 Polish-Bolshevik War, all Polish refugees and emigrants to the Soviet Union, anyone who had been a member of a Polish political party, and all anti-Soviet activists from Polish-speaking regions of the Soviet Union. The broad nature of the order led to the arrest of those who merely had a Polish-sounding last name. The guards were instructed to beat the Poles for all you are worth, which resulted in plenty of confessions as well as incriminations regarding other innocent people. As a result of this one NKVD order alone, over 100,000 people were executed without trial. Jewish socialists who escaped Hitler to the Soviet Union were accused of being not just filthy refugees, but also Nazi spies. Over 500,000 Jews were executed, while many others sent to prison camps. At last, the dreams of our beloved Tsar Nicholas, which he was too soft to carry out, are being fulfilled, quipped one captive. The prisons are full of Jews and Bolsheviks. German, Austrian, Yugoslav, Italian, Bulgarian, Finnish, Baltic, English, and French communists who emigrated to the USSR were all shot or imprisoned. Thousands of Polish communists fleeing Hitler were executed just in 1937. Historian Robert Conquest wrote how, after the defeat of the socialist rising in Vienna in 1934, several hundred members of the socialist defense organization Schutzbund took refuge in Russia. They were welcomed as heroes and marched past in a body in the Red Square to applause and congratulations. By mid-1937, they had been arrested and sent to camps almost without exception. Collecting stamps, speaking the international language of Esperanto, or simply having a pen pal were grounds for arrest. A veterinarian was even arrested for treating dogs that belonged to foreigners. The writer Isaac Babel was arrested and shot for having met French author André Malraux, which meant that Babel must have been a spy. His books remain with us, as does his mugshot, taken before he was executed at the age of 45. Pravda and Izvestia were the two major periodicals in the Soviet Union. Virtually their entire staffs were disappeared at one point. Not only was contact with the outside world considered virtually synonymous with spying, being a foreigner was in and of itself a mortal sin. The American Communist Party saw African Americans as a target group to further their cause, promising them a society based on full racial equality. Despite being a hero to leftists everywhere, FDR used very little political capital to further civil rights for African Americans. The 1935 pamphlet, The Negroes in a Soviet America, claimed that Roosevelt's policies have had the effect of increasing the slavery of millions of Negro toilers in the South, while the methods of the NAACP have proved to be treacherous. The argument was that among the most important allies of the working class is the Negro people in the United States, and that the communists fight for the right of the Black Belt territory to self-determination, meaning the creation of a Negro republic in approximately the present area in which the Negroes constitute a majority of the population. Langston Hughes, one of America's most beloved poets, fell in with the Soviets for a while, and NAACP co-founder W.E.B. Du Bois ended his days as a communist. More than a few Black Americans went to live in the Soviet Union as part of Stalin's outreach. Jamaican engineer Robert Robinson immigrated to the USSR in 1930. Years later, he admitted that every single Black I knew in the early 1930s who became a Soviet citizen disappeared from Moscow within 7 years. During 1937 and 38, the arrest turned to members of the government itself. The People's Commissars for Heavy Industry, Finance, Agriculture, Interior Trade, Education, Military Industry, Justice, State Farms, Communications, and Sea and River Transport were all arrested. The chairman of the State Bank was rounded up, as was the secretary of the Central Executive Committee. The president of the Ukrainian Republic vanished, while Pan Slupchenko, who held a position akin to Ukrainian prime minister, was arrested and killed himself in jail. All of his deputies and virtually all the other members of the party central committee were shot, a total of 99 of the 102 members. The president of the Belarusian Republic also killed himself. Stalin had introduced a new constitution in 1936, and everyone who had worked on it were later executed as traitors. The purges had also consisted of expelling a large percentage of lower-ranking members from the Communist Party. It had become all too apparent that even Soviet man responds to economic incentives, and that many people identified as Bolsheviks simply to further their position. By 1937, there was a concern that there were more ex-communists than there were current members of the party, and surely those kicked out of the party would hardly be expected to be loyal to it now. But those were the lucky ones. That 17th Congress where Kirov had been discussed as Stalin's probable successor ended in massacre. Specifically, of the 139 members and candidates of the Central Committee who were elected at the 17th Congress, 98 persons, i.e. 70%, were arrested and shot, mostly in 1937-38. In addition, of the 1,966 delegates with either voting or advisory rights, 1,108 persons were arrested on charges of anti-revolutionary crimes, i.e. decidedly more than a majority. The fewer people one knew and interacted with, the better. Not content with turning colleagues against one another in their given fields, Stalin's campaign took on a systemic attempt to create a society where no one could trust anyone else, including husbands and wives and parents and children, to say nothing of neighbors or coworkers or the like. The suspicion was akin to a web, as anyone who associated with an ex-communist or who had previously been known to associate with them once they had been party members became suspect. If two untrustworthy men grabbed lunch together, who's to say that they hadn't sat there conspiring against the people? Better to be safe than sorry when dealing with disgruntled potential saboteurs. The end result was the creation of guilt by association, but even the concept of guilt took on a radically different meaning. A person was inherently guilty if he opposed or was opposed by the state. That in and of itself was a crime, and not just a crime, but one for which death was often the necessary penalty. The government had no choice because millions of lives and the entire future of mankind were supposedly at stake. Being friends with an enemy of the state was a crime for not turning them in, but being ignorant that they were an enemy of the state was a crime for not being cautious enough. Author-philosopher Hannah Arendt explained the perverse incentives that the Great Terror unleashed into Russian society. Mass atomization in Soviet society was achieved by the skillful use of repeated purges, which invariably precede actual group liquidation. In order to destroy all social and family ties, the purges are conducted in such a way as to threaten with the same fate the defendant and all his ordinary relations, from mere acquaintances up to his closest friends and relatives. The consequence of the simple and ingenious device of guilt by association is that as soon as a man is accused, his former friends are transformed immediately into his bitterest enemies. In order to save their own skins, they volunteer information and rush in with denunciation to corroborate the non-existent evidence against him. This obviously is the only way to prove their own trustworthiness. Retrospectively, they will try to prove that their acquaintance or friendship with the accused was only a pretext for spying on him and revealing him as a saboteur, a Trotskyite, a foreign spy, or a fascist. Merit being gauged by the number of your denunciations of close comrades, it is obvious that the most elementary caution demands that one avoid all intimate contacts if possible, not in order to prevent discovery of one's secret thoughts, but rather to eliminate, in the almost certain case of future trouble, all persons who might have not only an ordinary cheap interest in your denunciation, but an irresistible need to bring about your ruin simply because they are in danger of their own lives. In the last analysis, it has been through the development of this device to its furthest and most fantastic extremes that Bolshevik rulers have succeeded in creating an atomized and individualized society, the likes of which we have never seen before, and which events or catastrophes alone would hardly have brought about. By design, the Soviet worldview was a complete inversion of Western bourgeois individualism. There will be some innocent victims in this fight against fascist agents, the head of the NKVD told his officers at one point. We are launching a major attack on the enemy. Let there be no resentment if we bump someone with an elbow. Better that 10 innocent people should suffer than one spy get away. When you chop wood, chips fly. Indeed, not having anyone to inform on might itself be taken as a form of guilt. If one's neighbors were all arrested for being spies or wreckers, why did the vigilant Soviet citizen not notice? A generalized sense of paranoia was heavily inculcated by the media and current events. A radio listener heard Chopin's funeral march played the day Zinoviev and Kamenev were executed and wrote in to share his suspicions that it was a signal from Trotskyite conspirators, recounted Fitzpatrick. Illiterate peasants were accused of being Trotskyists and went to prison asking